Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian. In this hour, most of our activity on the internet interacts with posts, memes, and videos that are driven by algorithms. How might algorithms be biased, racist, or sexist, and how might they amplify those biases in us? And first, how might people become addicted to social media, and what are the implications of such an addiction? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Stories about users of social media, problematic behavior with those users, proliferate the news these days. Increasingly, we all seem to be buried in our devices. We're reading stories, posting memes, sending messages back and forth. And there's no doubt the internet is becoming a more omnipresent part of our lives. But is social media addictive? I mean, in some forums, and including in courts, it's being compared to some pretty familiar addictions like alcohol, gambling, tobacco. What psychologically is happening when we engage in social media, and does that contribute to addictive behavior? On today's show, we're going to explore this question. Are we becoming addicted to our social media? Our guest is Ophir Terrell. He's professor of information systems management and the information systems group co-lead at the University of Melbourne. He's published over 250 journal papers. He's recognized in the top 2% of researchers worldwide by Stanford University Study. And to give you a sample, two of those titles include The Benefits and Dangers of Enjoyment with Social Networking Websites and Followers' Problematic Engagement with Influencers on Social Media, an Attachment Theory Perspective. Professor Terrell, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm going to ask you what sounds like a kind of a deceptively simple question. I suspect the answer is not all that simple. Are we addicted to social media, or is social media potentially addictive?
Thank you, Doug, and thank you for having me. This is a great question, but as you alluded to, it's not a simple one. Normally, I would turn the question back to the audience and ask them, what do you think addiction is, or what is addictive? Is eating too much food addictive? Is going fishing every weekend because you like it addictive? And I think the answer to the question really depends on the audience. On the one end, we have the medical community with a very formal and conservative view of addiction for right reasons. I mean, we don't want to over-pathologize everybody in the population and say they are addicted to something and start treating 50% of the population, just throwing a number out there. On the other end, we know that in the margins, we have some groups of people who are really suffering from whatever they engage in. And I think that's a key for something to become an addictive. It has to meet certain criteria. It has to be something that you really want, feel passionate about, want to do every time, first thing you want to do when you wake up. It has to have withdrawal symptoms, for example. So when you don't have access to this thing, and think about fishing as an example, when if you really like fishing and you don't have access to it during the week, maybe that's the only thing you want to do. You think about, you know, the next weekend I'm going to go fishing. But what's really important to keep in mind is that these things have to have negative consequences across life domains. And this is easy to understand in the case of substances, where you have certainly very severe consequences. It could be health consequences, overdose risk, legal risk if it's illicit substances. If it's gambling, we're talking about major financial losses. So these severe consequences are easy to understand in these cases. They are less easy to understand, or more difficult to understand, in the case of social media. And this is because these consequences vary, and they vary across stages of life, and sometimes they're transient. So what are the negative consequences that we see out there? We see in extreme cases, people cannot stop engaging with social media and lose their job. But for the most part, what we see is kids not doing their homework, if we're talking about school age, not socializing, not playing around with other kids, not engaging in sports, so less physical activity. Sometimes we see loss of sleep, which is, by the way, dangerous by itself because it can be associated with obesity and other issues. But overall, even though these are negative consequences, they're not as severe as overdose and risk of death. So the question is, where do you put the line? What is severe negative consequences? And the answer really varies on who you ask. So unfortunately, I do not have an easy answer for you.
I think there's two different ways to think about addiction, and you've emphasized the outcomes question, that addiction, when you get negative outcomes, then that certainly, and it makes sense that that's when you want to treat addiction. But isn't there a process element to this as well? Like thinking about, for example, you asked me how I would define addiction, and I think the first word that came to my mind is compulsion, that doing something because you like doing it is different than doing something because you feel a true compulsion to do it. How much of that is helpful in understanding that what's an addiction? Do you feel compelled to do it versus, I like doing it, but if I don't do it, I'm perfectly fine.
It's an important it's a great question as well. It's an important element or aspect or symptom of addiction, this loss of control that you described or loss of agency. At some point, addicted people feel that they really have no control over their life. And that's another important thing that distinguishes addiction to technologies and social media from addiction to substances. Substances have or cause neurotoxicity. So they basically affect the brain through the use of chemicals. And this is basically something that causes physical damage to the brain systems that govern self-control and agency to act in some cases. In contrast, social media sites and many other technologies do not cause physical damage to the brain regions that govern self-control and agency. So I think it's an important component, and it's good that you brought it up because it's one key factor that sort of separates typical traditional addictions from what we call social media addiction.
And also, when I think of addiction, when you talk about, for instance, substance abuse or alcohol abuse, et cetera, I know that there's a process within the brain where, you're seeking out this, whether it's, and again, this is not my area of specialty, but I think of what hitting up the dopamine receptors where you start feeling really good and you need to have that good feeling. And it makes sense when it's chemical. But when it's a behavioral issue like social media, or even one of the similarities that strikes me is like gambling, what's that process? Is it just kind of a social interaction that feels good and I want to go back and feel good again? Or is there something a bit more intense and deep going on?
It's much more complex, but I can take you through the details.
Okay.
So, for the brain is a reductionist machine, if you will, because a reward is a reward in the brain. It doesn't matter if it comes from eating a cake or sex or using substances. It's just a question of amount. So these activities produce dopamine, which makes us feel happy and what creates sense of enjoyment. And there is one system in the brain that is trained, I guess, for the survival of the species, that is trained to basically seek activities that produce dopamine. And that creates motivation to act. Without that, we wouldn't be eating, reproducing, and so on and so forth. So the system is well intended, but in some cases it's hijacked by activities that are too enjoyable, too accessible, and can basically, if repeated very frequently, can create changes in the brain that makes us feel compulsion to consume these things. So let's give a simple example. You, for the first time in your life, you eat a cake and it feels great. It releases dopamine. The brain learns that cake is associated with dopamine if you do it sufficient number of times. And then after a while, next time you see a cake, before you even consume the cake, the brain releases dopamine to create motivation to consume this cake. And over time, you try to consume increasing amounts of cake. Obviously, as humans, we don't always do that because we have a second brake system, a second system, brain system, that helps us govern and self-control. I made a mistake that I said brake because that's the analogy that I use. So the first system acts as an accelerator. The second system acts as a brake in a car. So the job of the second system is to tell you, you know what? You already had a piece of cake. Let's cut it. Don't consume the second piece of cake. So we have this game between a system that tells us consume more, I want more, it's good, and a system that tells us no, you should do something else or you shouldn't engage in this behavior. In most people, these systems are balanced and they're balanced in terms of strength, right? So the strength of the compulsion matches the strength of the self-control power. What happens? There are certain groups of people that do not have this balance. Children is one of them because for them, the brain system that governs rewards is fully developed, but or almost developed, and the self-control system matures by the age of 25 if you include the connections between the hemispheres. So that's natural imbalance. But substances and other addictive behaviors mess up this imbalance. So there are different ways to mess up this balance. One of them, the simplest one, is to really sensitize the reward system. So make your accelerator very sensitive. And this is what's happening in the case of social media and to some extent gambling, because individuals who engage in these really enjoyable behavior create changes in this brain region that governs reward generation or processing rewards. And that's fine. But most people in this category still have self-control or agency to take control over their lives. So let's say you're really addicted to social media. Or addict, I mean, I'm using quote unquote addicted. You really like using social media, but suddenly the website is down for a day or two. So you might feel agitated, but you know, you could, or if you feel that now you have a period of exams and you need to study, many people could say, okay, I'm putting this aside for 2, 3 days and I'll study for my exam. So people still have self-control because there are no chemical to mess up the brake system or the self-control system in the brain. Now, substances, in contrast, mess up both systems to create this imbalance. They sensitize the reward system with really large amounts of dopamine, for example, and they also create damage, physical damage to the brain regions that govern self-control.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today's topic is social media addictive, and in what ways is it addictive? What leads to that addiction? Our guest today is Ophir Terrell from the University of Melbourne. So it strikes me then, what you're describing here is that we have this sort of natural tendency, this natural need, and the brain is producing this need for behavior and maybe even pulling us in. But also, we have this brake system, yeah, that we learn to say no. Is this something that we develop, you know, over time? So therefore, it's fair to say that the lesser developed braking system, it's less developed in younger people. And so therefore, age can certainly play a pretty substantial factor in questions of addiction. So therefore, our focus on social media usage really should be focused on how much younger people are using it.
Yes, age is a factor in any addictive substance. So think about legislation regarding tobacco consumption, alcohol consumption, gambling. There is a reason why we prohibit younger individuals from consuming these substances. But certainly age is an important factor in decision making because of a natural trajectory in brain development. So in adolescence, so by the age of 11 to 14, the reward system, the system that governs dopamine release that creates motivation to act, is fully developed. The self-control system, which is in the prefrontal cortex, matures more slowly. It matures by the age of 19 to 21. But there are still elements, the connections between the left and right hemisphere, the corpus callosum, that mature by the age of 25, which means that full maturity is achieved by the age of 25. So we have this period of time between 11 to 14 to 21 to 25, where there is a natural imbalance between these two systems, which means that these individuals are disadvantaged in terms of their ability to make smart decisions.
Now, we've been focused on the process of becoming addicted, but you led off with one of the most important factors is what exactly are the consequences of addiction. What do you see as some of the greatest consequences? You highlighted things like if you're not doing your classwork and you're doing worse in school, but I'm also thinking of social interactions, the people that become so engaged in social media. All of their attention is directed at people who are not in the room versus developing social skills for the folks who are in the room. How serious do you see that as a consequence?
I think it's a major consequence. People need to develop, especially when we think about these younger ages, people need to develop social skills. And it's sad to see that anywhere in the world, doesn't matter where you are, you drive by, a school bus somewhere where there is a pickup for school bus. 20 years ago, it would be kids talking to each other. Now it's like kids on a screen. You go on a break from a class at the university. In the past, there used to be lots of interactions. Now you see 30 kids, each one on their phone, and social interaction is important. There is a lot of learning that goes on with that. Of course, it affects the way we respond to others and so on. I think there is another important aspect that was underemphasized in your question, which is, as opposed to controlling my social world, who I interact with and so on, when you interact socially on social media, primarily on social media, you are basically guided by an algorithm in some cases, or to some extent, which means that you lose control about who you interact, what you see, what kind of messages. So basically, you have some external entity that is interested in profit maximization, in maximal engagement. So basically, having you on your phone for the maximum, or on the website for maximum amount of time, because that ties to their ad revenues and so on, which is a legitimate business model, so it's not a criticism. But at the same time, when you basically let go and let them control what you see and so on, keep in mind that they're not interested in your social development or what's best for you. They're really interested in increasing your screen time. And when I say they, it's an algorithm that runs in the background and exposes you to content. So, you basically lose control over what kind of social environment you live in. You may be dragged into places that are unhealthy for you, talking about body image and or even things that relate to extremism. And so there are many ways where this can go wrong. Or we talk about simpler things, influencers that can convince you to buy things that you really don't need. So many ways where this can go wrong, because you give up control over your social environment to a machine that decides what's good for you.
And when you describe that, it made me think of another machine and asking how much different social media might be to concerns we'd always had with people who were, like, for instance, addicted to television. Because, of course, when you're consuming, television shows, the purpose of that the need for ad revenue is to keep you watching so they can sell you things during commercials. And of course, social media has that same, has that same interest. They want you to be engaged, but they also want to sell you things. So as a result, I guess there's two questions here. How different is social media from previous models? And is one of the real threats here that it really makes us primarily interested in consumerism rather than other factors in the development of, of our lives?
So social media is different, and it's different because in terms of scale, in terms of engagement, in terms of personalization. So your TV doesn't know you. If there is a show at 7, or you could pick your show that's on Netflix, that's fine. But with social media, it's very personalized. So they learn what you want, what you like, what would trigger negative emotions, what would trigger positive emotions, and what would keep you engaged. So it's like giving your TV a lot of personal information, and every it flip channels for you or offer you, suggest some shows for you. Also, there is a big difference because social media is accessible 24/7 anywhere. Whereas your TV, it's something you do at your leisure time after you're done work, after you're done. I mean, I can't see you in your office, pulling TV and watching TV while working, whereas you could pull your phone and use your social media and forget your next meeting because you were too absorbed with social media. So big difference. I said another element is the type of screen that is used. So social media is in many cases consume over a smartphone or via smartphones, TV on big screen that are far away from you, and that has implication for sleep disturbances. So the distance of the source of light from your eyes is a factor that affects melatonin release or suppression in your brain. And therefore, when you consume content via smartphones or tablets that are closer to your eyes compared to a large TV screen that is typically, I don't know, 6, 8, 9, 10 feet from your eyes, it's a very different experience in terms of physiological impact on melatonin release. So I just highlighted several differences. This is not an exhaustive list, but I think with smartphones and the way we consume social media and the way it personalizes things, it makes it much more compelling and much more dangerous compared to television.
By the way, you were talking about how the algorithm can get to know you. That seems to then lead to, some of the outcomes, and we certainly have heard lots of news stories about this, including with the ongoing case against Facebook and YouTube about issues like young women and body image, or this perceptions, for all users about the idealism of life, and then kicking people into depression because they're not realizing what they're being told is the ideal world within social media. Now, there have been those accusations with commercials and television and movies, et cetera, for years and years. But it's fair to say, because of the omnipresent nature of social media, it's just taken what was a trend and made it just all the more intense.
Yes, it also allows something broader. So I wrote a paper a couple of years ago about social comparisons. And we humans have this tendency to engage in upward social comparisons. We compare ourselves to people who do better than us. And this is generally good because this is what drives us, motivates us to do better in life. This person is doing better than me, I should work harder and so on. But this system breaks at some point because when this comparison becomes basically makes you believe that it's impossible to achieve whatever this other person achieves, you just give up and engage in riskier behaviors to try to achieve this goal that you set in your mind. The problem is that when we grew up, we had a couple of, think about your social circle. It was probably people in your neighborhood, your family. So people in geographical proximity, some kids in your class, right? So school, and that was it. Now we have people who are exposed to millions of people online, And many of them do better than themselves, right? So instead of comparing yourself to your neighbor, your next door neighbor, now your social comparison is to Kim Kardashian. And oh, she's always on some island having fun, and she has so many followers, and every time she posts, she gets so many likes, and I get only 10 likes when I post something. So this creates an impression that you need to do more to achieve more in your life. Now, it's not fair to say that by itself this is a cause for depression or risky behavior, because it really depends on how people appraise the situation. So sometimes it is appraised positively, like, oh, I need to work harder to get there. But in many cases, it's not. It depends on your life circumstances and could be other pre-existing conditions. And in such cases, you may reappraise it as something negative and say, oh, I give up. I don't want to do anything. I just can't take it anymore. So it really depends on how you interpret the situation. But social media certainly accentuated this mechanism and gave people access to social comparison targets that they didn't have before.
The way you frame that, I think, it helps me to frame this question because at one level, we all individually have different interactions with social media. We have different motivations, different reactions to these things. And so framing the response individually probably makes the most sense. But from a broad perspective, if you could change from a policy perspective, you can implement a policy that could help address these concerns, what would you focus on?
That's a difficult question, because I think, first of all, children need to be protected. So I'm not fully convinced that the debate on addiction versus non-addiction is something that is, I guess, it's on the legal side of things. It really defines on how you define social media, by the way, which we didn't discuss, is YouTube social media, etc., Discord. And how you define addiction and where you put sort of the threshold between something that is really engaging and enjoyable and you repeat, which is fine. Think about food. Is food an addiction? Can you become addicted to food? So it's a very complex question. But there is no doubt that there are people who suffer from this situation, whether you call it an addiction or not. And the suffering is accentuated among teenagers. Because this is an age in their life where social comparisons are very important, where they sort of build their social status and self-confidence. This is an age where they learn to socially interact. It's an age that defines their career trajectories later in life, right? So if you do well in high school, that really affects your career trajectory. So it can have major implications also for the opinions that they develop. So if we were to do something, it would be to probably regulate social media to some extent. And I'm not big on fully regulating things, but to some extent to make it more controllable when it comes to young individuals. So this is something along the lines of the age restrictions that were set in Australia, and now other countries consider. There could be other things. And when you think about regulation, it's a complex question, because there are different ways to regulate it. It could be at the federal level, at the state level. It could be something as simple as some sort of taxation, some sort of age verification. Could be many ways. I leave it to the experts.
And I think it's a good place to end this part of the conversation. There's so much more that we're developing in these areas. We've been talking about, is social media addictive? What does addiction mean? And what are some of the ways in which you might be able to confront these addictions? Our guest today has been Ophir Terrell. He is a professor of information systems management and the Information Systems Group co-lead at the University of Melbourne, published over 250 journal papers. Two examples of that: the benefits and dangers of enjoyment with social networking websites, and followers' problematic engagement with influencers on social media, an attachment theory perspective. Professor Terrell, thank you so much for joining us, for sharing your time and your expertise on such an important issue.
My pleasure. Thank you.
When we come back, What biases might be driving or determining the content of our social media feeds, and what is the impact of that? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What do the biases of social media algorithms mean for our online experience? Do they reinforce racism, sexism, homophobia, negative body image, or other forms of concerning biases? Or do they amplify these isms? Doug Becker revisits his earlier conversation.
I'm Doug Becker. This segment is a section of a longer show that you can find on our website at scholarscircle.org. More and more of our lives are spent online. But perhaps even more importantly, more of our lives are determined by artificial intelligence and filtering systems that determine the information we receive, the framing of our worlds, and increasingly the products advertised to us. Frances Haugen, we now know her as the Facebook whistleblower, has revealed the extent to which that company is guided by its profit model and guided by a number of new technologies. And even a recent Hollywood kind of children's film, Space Jam, A New Legacy, placed as its villain, the algorithm. What are algorithms? How do they influence our lives? Are they perpetuating biases and discrimination in society? And are they having an influence, an impact on our democracy and on our representation? We're joined today by Tina Ilyasi-Rod, professor of computer science at Northeastern University. She is the author of Measuring Algorithmically Infused Societies and What Science Can Do for Democracy, a Complexity Science Approach. Damian Patrick Williams, assistant professor in philosophy and data science at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. He is the author of Why AI Research Needs Disabled and Marginalized Perspectives, and fitting the description, Historical and Sociotechnical Elements of Facial Recognition and Anti-Black Surveillance. And Henning Schulzerina, professor in the Department of Computer Science at Columbia University. He's the co-author of Mobility Protocols and Handover Optimization, Design, Evaluation, and Application, and Building Communications and the Physical World and Future Internets Escape the Simulator. He is also an Internet Hall of Fame innovator from 2013 and was the Chief Technology Officer for the United States Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, under the Obama administration. Professor Ilyasi-Rod, one of the big concerns about algorithms is that they seem to be kind of closed source, the sense that there's something making decisions that really aren't completely transparent. Is this an essential part of algorithms, this kind of lack of transparency, or can they be transparent?
So there's a whole area of folks who are studying transparency of algorithms, and there's nothing stopping algorithms being transparent. In fact, as was just mentioned, algorithms are just the recipe. So mandatory minimum sentencing is an algorithm. Three strikes and you're out is an algorithm, right? It's very, very transparent. The issue becomes that the algorithms that affect our lives these days use a lot of the data that we're providing all the platforms, governments, organizations, etc. And then oftentimes those data are fed into algorithms that are black boxes. And some of your audience may have heard about deep learning or deep neural networks or deep fake videos, right? So all of the algorithms that use those are part of that technology are black boxes. We do not know what the algorithm is doing. Having said that, not all machine learning algorithms are black boxes. There are machine learning algorithms that are transparent and interpretable. That is, you can crack open the box and see exactly what the recipe is. But there is one slight caveat, if I may. If the company who is developing that algorithm, then that company won't release the algorithm. That's their secret sauce, right? And so then you don't know what they're using. You can try to audit it, right? And people are doing that too. A whole group of people are also looking at auditing algorithms, like auditing Uber's algorithm in terms of pricing, auditing Amazon's algorithms. But those algorithms are all closed to us in the public, even if they are interpretable within the company.
Maybe to just add to that, if I may, namely, one of the things that has changed is that many of these newer algorithms are much more adaptive than the old ones. So what you had, come on, think of a credit score, a classical high impact algorithm, which is opaque in a sense that I have no idea which numbers go into my credit score, and none of the credit bureaus will tell me. They're not using, maybe now, but they certainly weren't using any AI before, but the algorithm was probably relatively stable. So they could theoretically release that to certainly a regulator. They could show that to somebody informed at the regulator, at a financial services regulator, and they could prove that, let's say, sensitive facts, say gender, race, are not factored into that. But what they couldn't today, the algorithms often are, particularly the better ones, they learn over time. So that the algorithm that I experience today isn't the same, even though the basic machinery is not changed, is that the weights on the deep neural networks, which essentially combine these inputs into a decision, they're not the same today as they were yesterday. So saying I'm disclosing the algorithm is meaningless because that discloses what happened last week. It doesn't disclose what happens tomorrow. And they also are much more amenable, these type of algorithms, for incorporating new data sources. So in particular, old algorithms were generally pretty dumb in terms of number of data sources. And as was just mentioned, you now have this problem that you have much more data that you can all feed in. Much of it is essentially ignored, as if you were to look under the hood of the algorithm. But you don't really know which of these thousands of data points actually influence the algorithm. And so the transparency is often much harder to accomplish, even if you were to specify, yep, we're looking at these 1,000 data points, most of them probably have almost no influence in it, or under only a peculiar small set of circumstances. So.
And Damien Williams, I know you've done research into some of the different biases that have been built into algorithms. Are the current use of algorithms reproducing the racial biases that we see in society?
Not just the racial biases, but the gendered biases, the, biases towards sexuality, biases towards the nature of gender and sexuality, the nature of health and disability. All of these biases are instantiated within these systems. And that's because we should be very careful about something here. Biases are perspectives, right? And the biased perspectives are perspectives. They're the perspectives of the human beings who collected this data, who organized the data regime under which data was to be collected in the first place, let alone how it was then to be trained into the systems themselves. And human beings swim in a sea of the perspectives and influences of the values and cultures of other human beings. We are at all times products of perspectives and biases. So yeah, we have these biases instantiated within these systems because how could we not? We built them. We made them, and so they are definitely going to have us within them. The only way we could ever even possibly get a clearer sense of these things is just having the transparency of what factors are being considered doesn't in any way get to where we need to be, knowing how transformations are taking place, knowing what kinds of weights are being given at the outset, what ways it's being trained to operationalize those different weightings, those different considerations, the kinds of preferences it's been told to give to certain types of data. That's the kind of thing that allows us to have a fuller picture. And even then, we're talking about so many thousands of points of data, so many thousands of types of operations, so many different values and beliefs and perspectives that have been embedded from the people who have built the data set, the people who have done the training, the people who have built the algorithm and told it to operate in different ways, that at the end of the day, we're talking about a ridiculously difficult set of operations. But it's also deeply crucial that we start to think of it in terms of how difficult it is, and to think about in terms of what is at stake in the operations of these procedures and these algorithms.
Professor Eliassi-Rad.
So there are lots of excellent points there. So one, in fact, there is a website called the Library of Missing Datasets, where, you know, we have lots of data for the privileged folks in our communities and in societies, but not on the marginalized folks. And then the other aspect of it is most of the algorithms that you were talking about up front are being trained on data that's available publicly on the internet. So there was a lot of media around these large language models like BERT or GPT-3, where, oh my gosh, we have passed the Turing test, we have strong AI, right? I type in two Muslims walk into a bar and it completes the rest, right? The problem is that it's being trained on data that's on the internet, it's not curated. So if you type two Muslims walk into a bar, it says, and they blow it up, right? And in fact, there was a recent paper that was shown that this data that they are using is full of language that is misogynistic, racist, Islamophobia, all kinds of things. And so there are issues around this data that was really nicely mentioned, but it doesn't end with the data. But it is a big part, just the data and what they're using.
Yeah, and this is Damien again. To continue along that vein, this is something that we've known about going back to thinking about word-to-vec operations, thinking about, you know, natural language programming as a whole. The effects of the Enron corpus on natural language programming models has been studied a great deal at this point. And the fact that, you know, when you have a group of people who in their private communications are using highly sexist and otherwise bigoted language to have conversations about the acts of large-scale economic fraud that they're committing, and then you use those communications as the training data and the training framework for natural language models, that you're going to embed within those models some very problematic things. And to think that that wouldn't be the case, to somehow not consider that that would end up being the case in the first place, is astounding. And then we can talk about Tay and Microsoft's massive failures with Tay, and then exactly a year later with Zoe, you know, the failures of letting these systems loose on the internet with no guidance and no restriction, and then being somehow shocked that they came back racist and misogynistic and bigoted. Like that. Yeah. I'm sorry, but Twitter's a cesspool.
Indeed. And one of the things which is interesting is that this is not just on the social data. So I just wanted to make a point. So for example, oximeters, where we were all wanting to buy oximeters to measure the amount of oxygen in our blood. There was all this news about, oh, these oximeters don't work on darker skinned people because of the technology that they use. Well, this was known way back in the 80s, but nobody did anything. And now all of that data is being fed into algorithms that are being used in medicine. And so there is this notion of who's privileged in our society and who's not. And so the algorithms mimic the privileged, work for the privileged, not for the folks that are marginalized.
And Henning, then it makes me think, ultimately, what we're really talking about, what's made algorithms such a fascinating and such a potentially obtrusive part of our lives, is the management of the massive amount of data that's now being collected. First, is it fair to say we're collecting more data than ever before, and that the algorithms are basically ways in which that we're trying to manage this massive amount of data with all of the potential biases, because we're the ones doing the managing of the data?
It's helpful to look at why we actually use these systems. So some of it is just because we can. Some of the examples were mentioned, it's just cool to do that stuff with often predictably, unpredictably bad result, but maybe not as harmful as others might be. And the others is a sense that existing systems are insufficiently efficient. So I mentioned early on the loan officer model. The financial services industry has an interest in getting rid of loan officers. Well, needless to say, those were hardly unbiased arguments either. It's not like these were the paragons of racial and gender neutrality in that. So there is a concern and a legitimate concern that many of these manual techniques had their own issues, and they often had, from a management perspective, issue that you get these kind of very embarrassing things that real estate agents steer their clients in certain ways that you find out later. At least if you run the algorithm, if you're at least careful, you might have a little bit more control over that than these pesky independent real estate agents that act in ultra-human ways. But what I wanted to emphasize is a different way to maybe to think about it. Namely, one is that many of the highest impact algorithms are really designed for people who run those to prevent bad things happening. There's a very high risk of somebody not repaying their loan. They lose all of that money as a bank. There's somewhat of a high risk of admitting students to a program that don't complete. That makes me look, as an institution, since we all are affiliated with institutions, all of those institutions want to have high graduation rates. That makes us look good in the rankings. And so many of these, the highest kind of risk algorithms from a human perspective are the ones that are essentially designed to mitigate institutional risk, not make bad loans, not admit unqualified students, not to release defendants who probably shouldn't be released, all of those. And what's really hard is leaving aside kind of just what you might call ignorance, stupidity, or worse, is that it's often very difficult to do what happens if I make some different decision? I can't admit a different set of students. I can't necessarily release a different set of people after booking them. I can't make different loans for the same people and see what happens. So often the difficult part is even figuring out, is there a better algorithm that I could have used and maybe should have used, and that is hard, leaving aside that there's some many low-hanging fruits of those identified where we clearly should have done as a community, collectively as a computer science and public policy community, as in somebody should have said, hey, like 1980s, we know this is not something that we need to reproduce every time. We know better by now, but the harder questions are the ones is, what do you do for cases where running alternatives is just hard?
Tina, you want to speak?
If I may follow up on that, one of the issues is that when people use algorithms, they believe that the algorithm is somehow objective. And in fact, when algorithms are being used in, for example, criminal justice, it seems like they're being used as expert systems, but they're not being treated as expert systems. So when I get called to a court as an expert, they ask me, why are you an expert? You know, and I need to prove that I am an expert, versus these algorithms are being used and no questions are asked. Cesar Hidalgo wrote this great book that came out at MIT Press called How Humans Judge Machines, where he looked at it from the psychology perspective. And when harm is done by a machine, people don't assign intent to that machine. But when harm is done by a human, they assign intent to that human, where that machine came from somewhere. Somebody made that machine. So for some reason, intent does not transfer through the machine. And so we don't have accountability, right? So if the Arnold Foundation's public safety assessment tool is used and I wrongly am sent to jail where I should have been released while I wait for my day in court, who's to blame? if I bring something like a toaster to my house and it burns my house down, I can sue the toaster company. And those are things that we're still working through. And of course, the law is very slow.
To follow on there as well, I would just like to say, you know, there's the fact of certain areas having been known for even longer than the 80s. You know, we were talking about the oximeters, but we can go as far back as the spirometer and spirometry, and the measurement of breath has a long history of racialized bias, and yet it still exists. We're talking 1800s measurements of breath that have persisted to the technologies that we use to do so today. And we're talking about the fact that there are graduating classes of doctors right now who still have the belief that Black people have a higher tolerance for pain than white people. Like, this is as of a report as of 2019, that this is an extant belief in medical practitioners, something that has been debunked and was thought to have been demystified long hence. There's a quote by Dr. Debbie Chatra, works at Olin College, and it's kind of an updating of Arthur Clarke's law. It goes, "Any sufficiently advanced neglect is indistinguishable from malice." And so if you know for long enough that there has been a lacuna or multiple lacunae, that there has been something raised to the attention of the public often by those who've been harmed by it, and it hasn't been done anything about, even if the intent to harm is not there, that doesn't change the fact that the harm persists and is amplified and iterated upon in whole hosts of new ways. Mm.
Damien, if I can follow up then, because one of the themes here is that we've known about some of these limitations and we've known about these challenges. Why haven't there been improvements in these areas? You said we haven't done anything to improve this. Why?
It kind of goes back to something that Professor Elias Arad said earlier. These things are treated as objective, right? We talk about math and we talk about code as if they are objective tools or tools that allow us to remove subjective perspectives from the work that we are doing. If it is instantiated in mathematics, if it's instantiated in code, then it is read to be by the external world and by many non-experts and even experts who make use of them as objective fact. When the fact of the matter is that those codes were written by someone, as we've all said at multiple points today, these codes were created by humans. The perspectives of those humans have made their way into those codes, even in ways that people do not expect or suspect. There's a practice within social sciences known as bias bracketing. Right? And it kind of gets at a lot of what we're talking about here. It's the process of being able to look your biases, your perspectives, your habits of thought, you know, examine them and ask yourself the question, do I make this decision because it is the right decision or the most likely decision in general? Or do I make this decision because it is my habit, because it is the perspective that I have, because it is the expectation of the world and the pattern that I seek to fit? At present, no algorithm can fully bracket its own biases. No system can truly examine itself for the biases that it has, the patterns and habits of thought, and ask itself, did I go down this path because I went this way, because it was the most likely outcome, or because it was the most likely outcome I was told to expect, to look for?
Along those lines, which is very interesting. So I teach this undergraduate course to first year students about algorithms that affect lives. And the students are amazing. And they're like, is there a tool that I can use that will tell me how I'm being manipulated on these sites, on Twitter, on Facebook, etc.? We do not have that tool that will tell you as the user how you're being manipulated. Like, if I click on this link versus that link, what would happen? Or there's all this money that's going into explainable AI. And in some of these platforms, they have these question marks that you can click on, like, why am I seeing this ad? And the explanations are so broad. I am showing you this because you're a female between 18 and 65 and you live in the US. Well, that's clearly not exactly it. And then there are others that are just like demographics, right? So I have a friend who's a female. After she turned 30, she was shown all these Facebook ads about losing weight, because clearly after 30, you want to lose weight if you're female in America. The only way she could get rid of it was to go into Facebook and change her profile gender to male. And then she got all these other kinds of ads that she didn't want to see, right? So there's all this other background stuff that's happening that we do not see. You know, Facebook has two books on each person. There's the one you tell them, and people lie all the time, and then what they infer about you based on your activity.
Our panel today has been Tina Ilyasi-Rod, professor of computer science at Northeastern University. She's the author of Measuring Algorithmic Infused Societies and What Science Can Do for Democracy, a Complexity Science Approach. Damian Patrick Williams, assistant professor in philosophy and data science at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. He is the author of Why AI Research Needs Disabled and Marginalized Perspectives, and Henning Schulterinner, professor in the Department of Computer Science at Columbia University. He's the co-author of Mobility Protocols and Handover Optimization, Design, Evaluation, and Application. He is an Internet Hall of Fame innovator from 2013. Thank you.
This segment is a section of a longer show that you can find on our website at scholarscircle.org.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.